I was expecting a Canadian, and we got an Australian. It was jarring. I mean, whenever you get a surprise Australian, it's going to be jarring.
Hello and welcome to The Dirt. I'm Tim Wright, and today I'm here with Steve Hickey.
Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve. And I'm also here with the co-authors of A Web for Everyone, Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks Hello. For having us on.
Thanks for coming. This is outstanding. We're really thrilled to have you. So this is a part in a series we're doing about experience development, which is, so there's experience design and then experience development, which is kind of the coding side of building out an experience. And this specific episode is about accessibility and universal access, which is why we wanted to have Sarah and Whitney on, because they are recognized experts in the area. Here at Fresh Till Soil, we very much believe in universal access. We host Global Accessibility Awareness Day. We run accessibility user tests. We have a partnership with the Perkins School for the Blind. It's really great. We really push for it. And we're really happy to have you guys on today.
Well, it's great to be here.
So I guess right off the bat, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. I mean, there have been accessibility books before, and there are others, but they're largely very much focused on the how-to and the coding side. And we wanted a book that would speak to developers, I mean, speak to designers, that would speak to people who are thinking about how to put a product together, not just how to code that product. And one of the things that we came to is that a lot of what makes good accessible design is doing the things we do just a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we also, both of us together, when we first started writing together, we are both very enthusiastic about the concept of universal design as a way to approach accessibility, because it just has a lot of elegance to it. And so the idea is really basically that to resolve issues or provide accessibility features that are needed for everyone to be able to participate, you embed design into the environment. And it's a concept that it has principles and guidelines that are really geared toward the physical environment and the built environment, but they totally work online. They rock. You just have to like do a little bit of extrapolation, but they totally apply. And so what we started out with are these design principles, and the first chapter of the book covers them and some other principles that also get us excited. And so that's where we started with the universal design principles. And then from there really grew into something where we kind of ended up in a surprising place for me anyway, where we had principles for accessible user experience. And I don't think when we started out, I think we intended to focus very much on these universal design principles and kind of try to translate them to the web. But in the end, as we worked through and iterated and rewrote, we ended up with a set of accessible user experience principles and guidelines, and we love how it came out, actually.
Yeah, we do too.
I think it's such a great approach to the topic, and I really wish that there was more focus on that in design school and when designers are just getting started out in the field, because I remember looking back on how it was, how the topic was brought up in my classes and how I thought of it. It was always sort of, oh, great, more constraints. That's awful, but the more you think about it, and the more experienced you get, the more you realize that it's not just, oh, more constraints and now my design can't be good. It's, this is actually going to make things better for everyone. These are great constraints to have in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, because we started, in fact, the first principle is people first. Mm-hmm. But then when we go into the rest of the principles, they're really about the different aspects you have to think about in design, right? So what's the structure? You know, how does it, what's the style of interaction? How do people find their way around the app or the site? And that really for us was about this extra dimension. There's, you know, diverse devices, there's diverse people, but there's also depth to every application. You know, everything we create has all these different aspects, and we have to think about people in all of those.
Yeah, I remember the first time universal access or universal design was explained to me. I think it was at a accessibility conference in Southern California, and Derek Featherstone was the keynote, and I sat in on this session on Way Aria by James Craig. Mm-hmm. James Craig. He was accessibility guy at Apple, and he was explaining to me in real world terms, like the cut in the sidewalk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it's mm-hmm. there for wheelchairs, but there's a lot of people who can use it. It's not just for people with wheelchairs. It could be, you know, people pushing carriages or someone who, I don't know, some sort of a wheeled device going onto the sidewalks.
Anything. Dragging one of those
rolling suitcases. Yeah. Bicycles.
Grocery carts. All sorts of stuff.
I use it a lot on my skateboard and my roller skates.
But yeah, it made so much sense to me. And just there's a lot of things from an accessibility standpoint that we get for free in the browser, just like natural form controls and the way they hook up. And it's so frustrating for me to see those natural things you get for free be broken or just ignored or
even overwritten.
Overwritten is super frustrating.
Well, if you think about it, the same thing that lets me set my word, you know, I usually run any word document at 125, 135%. The same thing that lets me make that just a little bit bigger for my not so great eyes also lets you make it really bigger if you need really bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I use a program called Flux that changes the color temperature of the screen so it's not so blue and glary. But it turns out that that's really great for people who are very sensitive to harsh blue light, so they can just take their screen and set it. So it wasn't designed for accessibility, but it turns out to be really useful for accessibility.
Yeah. And I would probably fall into the demographic of those people who are sitting there designing things with tiny typefaces because our eyes are great and we can see everything. But recently I've actually been experiencing issues with quality of light and things like that. And so even though at first glance I might look like somebody who wouldn't care about that stuff, it is starting to affect me as well. And it sort of changes the way you think about that stuff.
For those who can't see Steve right now, who just said that he has great vision, he has the thickest glasses that
those
I've ever
not
seen
the
in my
thickest
life.
Glasses. No. Hey, I can correct to 2015 with these bad boys.
Yeah, well, that's the point, is that you know, the invention of eyeglasses made poor vision a correctable disability.
Yeah.
And we can make lots of things correctable disabilities digitally if we just set out to do it.
Mm-hmm. I really like that you said people first back when we started this point, because I felt for a while that for a lot of junior designers, they really feel like designs are for designer first more than anything else. And it's a huge growth point when a designer finally gets past that and starts to really consider the importance of everyone else but themselves in the work they do.
Well, it's sort of a mastery thing, right?
Yeah.
When you're first starting out, you're just struggling to learn your tools. And then when you finally get to the point where the tools become invisible, then you can start branching out and doing more things. I think it's why there's a natural progression in anything like digital design, where you sort of go through an apprenticeship where first you do the little stuff and then you grow to bigger and bigger. And then eventually you get to really be the person in control of the whole vision.
Yeah.
And at that point, what we want to make sure is that the people in that vision aren't just the five people around you, but lots of different people.
Yeah. Yeah. So some pattern that I've noticed in web design, when new things come up, they always get shoved to the back of the list. So when I first started learning about accessibility a while ago, 40, 50 years ago at this point, feels like, it was, you know, we would build our site and then like, okay, now let's make it accessible. And then when mobile came along, it was, okay, we have this site, now let's make it mobile. Then user testing came along, let's make the site, now let's user test. Everything gets thrown on the end and kind of, and over time, it naturally goes into the normal process. I started to see that with accessibility, and I've actually started to see it get moved back out, and I don't know why that's happening. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do have lots of thoughts on that.
Bring it on.
So I work for the Pass Yellow Group, and we do... we work with people who are looking at accessibility of their products and services, digital accessibility purely, but sometimes that's televisions and telephones too. So it's an awesome job. I'm having a blast. But I'm a user experience person on that team, but I also do tech work. And so a lot of time the sort of the typical engagement with TPG has been that someone has built a designed a product, built a product, launched a product, and now is looking at accessibility. And we are brought in to review the accessibility against guidelines and identify all the points of failure and the points that are not failures, and provide recommendations for how to remediate them. And so that's, I would say, that encapsulates a very immature approach to accessibility, but that has been where we've been sort of on a continuum. It's been a retrofitting activity.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm in the user experience area. So what's been really cool over the, I guess, 2 and almost 3 years now that I've been with TPG is we're seeing more and more engagements where the people who have been doing this work are like, oh, it's just like pain and suffering. You're giving me all this bad news at the end of a project, and how am I going to fix all this stuff? And it's just like everybody suffers. The people who use the product, the people who built it, it's just pain and tears and awfulness everywhere. And so so now what we're getting is folks coming and saying, you know, we've been doing this wrong all along, and we have been putting it in QA or even later. How about we start talking about accessibility right at the start? And that's what Whitney and I talk about. I mean, our book, that's the basis for our book. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's start from...
Absolutely.
Start from people, right? Like Whitney said, we start from people and go all the way through to process and onward and maintenance. And so that's the good news, really, is that we're seeing more and more engagements now that have us looking at wireframes at actually we're working with organizations to change culture and practice in a fundamental way so that everyone's adopting their role and responsibility within the realm of providing accessibility as it maps to whatever their role is in the organization. If they're a business analyst, they're learning what they need to specify in the requirements. If they're a QA person, they're learning how to test for it. So it's a really, really good time. And to your point, I think it's a time of progress right now where we're really having a much more mature view on what it means to do accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
And doing is not like after the fact, right. Remediating.
Yeah, it's been nice that the last year, I feel like the clients I've been dealing with, it's been really easy to persuade them that accessibility is a serious concern that needs to be approached from the beginning. I remember at a previous job trying to explain to people that we need to make sure something was accessible, and they're just like, well, what'll it cost us to do that? So they're going, I don't care what it will cost us to do that. It's the right thing to do.
I have two sides of the, it's been easy to convince people. It has been, but I don't like the method. And like sometimes you have to push people as far to say, like, look at all these lawsuits because of, you know, people weren't compliant. I don't like having to do that. But I mean, the end result is that you're getting to implement these accessible features. So it's kind of like, I guess.
You know, I'd say there are two big influencers, and one is the mobile phone or mobile devices, mm-hmm. in general, and the other is lawsuits. I mean, even if there's not a lawsuit, almost everybody I talk to today, one of the questions I now ask them is, has there been a law conversation? And they're getting more, I think they're hearing more from people who are writing in and saying, I had trouble using a website. And then, and the lawyers are taking that seriously earlier and not just waiting for it to become a lawsuit. We're both real fans of a lawyer named Lainey Feingold who does structured negotiations instead of lawsuits. She's still a lawyer. She's still writing an official, mm-hmm. letter. But what she says is, you know, we have a problem. Let's work on this together. And it's a very different approach than I'll sue your ass.
Yeah.
I mean, when people feel threatened, they behave much more differently than would under normal circumstances.
Mm-hmm. But the other one is mobile, right? I mean, first of all, mobile has forced us to think clearly about purpose, right? So the whole mobile first movement actually creates things that, if they haven't screwed it up, are often accessibility first as well, because they're simpler and they're clearer and there's not so much stuff to move, you know, to get through. And there's, so that's helped. And I think the other thing that's helped is that with this sort of advent of all the mobile, then digital experiences are now much more everyday. And when it was a few, you know, a small percentage of people who did stuff online, and you could make the case for the cost of to the business if their sites weren't very good. But now people expect to be able to get to your mobile site, and it's really pretty broad. And I think that's helped because now, instead of just thinking about the five percent people who just love digital because they love digital, we're now thinking about people who just want to book a table at a restaurant or mm-hmm. buy something online mm-hmm. or find out where they're going. And that means that we're now really looking at a much broader range of human experience, even without dealing with the big disabilities. We're looking at a broader range of people. And I think that that makes a big difference in how you think about design, and who you've brought to the table at the beginning affects what that product looks like at the end.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the biggest pitfalls that you see, like biggest mistakes in accessibility, just seeing people like commonly really make, other than ignoring it until the end, obviously?
Well, I think the place where I still see a lot of waiting till the end is people will say, well, we'll do all our user research and we'll design the product and then we'll do some research with people with disabilities. And so it's the same kind of pushing it off to the side. We've just moved it into that design research area. But I've started doing things where I just open up my recruiting, right? Look for more people. We, you know, look for people who have low literacy and low vision, as well as people who are, you know, blind or deaf, or, you know, make sure that you've got people who are older and younger and greener and bluer and, you know, different dimensions of people. And that changes how we do the research, because if you're accommodating people who use different computers in different ways, who use different devices, then you can't just say, I'm going to sit them down in front of the computer that I've prepared, and it's a narrowly prepared computer, and we're going to be able to record on it. You have to be much more flexible about their technology, and maybe it means going where they are. Instead of bringing people to your lab, maybe you bring your lab to a community center or to a community library, and find ways to make it easier for people to be part of your work. There's a slogan that's been going around the civic design community, which is design with and not for, or work with and not for, right? So instead of us, it's back to that genius designer thing, right? Yeah, we may think we may be great designers, but great designers are inspired by the people they're designing for. And so how do we let those people have a voice in what they want their experience to be like? It is, after all, their experience that we're trying to create.
Yeah, we run an apprenticeship program here, and one of the things I love most about it is the first time that apprentices see a user test of the work that they've done. Within 5 minutes, they're just sitting there scribbling notes down madly because they've never seen somebody use their work before. It's crazy, but it changes their perception of the process so much.
Setting it all up and getting that into the practice is hard, but it's like a shortcut. It's like chutes and ladders, you know. Oh, I thought this was great. Oh, not so much. Oh no, this is really cool. You know, which things are the ladders that help people succeed? Which things are the chutes that kind of drop them down into that horrible moment when they're not going to use your product?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking about something, I think, yesterday in preparation for the show, that one of the things that we're seeing come up is people being 508 compliant, but still open to litigation.
Yeah, we've
seen. Which I thought was really interesting.
Different cases have established that even though you might be compliant with the law, because a case was decided in favor of the plaintiff, even though there wasn't a legal violation, that's established that further lawsuits can happen.
Yeah, so that definitely happens. And yeah. I guess it's very complicated, obviously.
Yeah.
So let me just even figure out where to even come in on that. So one thing is that compliance is make-believe.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, you might have a product that, well, first of all, a product, let's just talk about your typical like web application or even just an informational website. There are so many pages within a website. And so you can't say that there are 500 pages. You're not going to look at 500 pages as an audit and then evaluate each page against each component on each page against each standard in the 508 specification or in the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. And so what you do, often some groups will take a sample from that. So cut that 500 down to, let's say, 20 mm-hmm. and look at those 20 representative samples and then say, okay, Here are the issues with those 20. Now extrapolate what you've learned from these 20 and fix everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that compliance might look like that. Like it might be, okay, somebody looked at 20 pages and we fixed everything else that was identified and now we're compliant. But that's even at a moment in time. And 5 minutes later, right, something happens and you're out of compliance and then your site isn't accessible. But that's just the compliance and the standards piece. And it's, and all standards are really good for is measuring attributes of an environment. That's it. So then even if you do have a compliant website, then somebody has to use it, right?
Yeah. I mean, standards are like the minimum list of things that we think at the time we write the standard might produce the result we want.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're the things that we can agree on as you know, the comrades in arms of the goal.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the goal.
Yeah, they don't necessarily make it accessible. You've checked off all the items on your list, but it still might not be usable.
The same is true for usability. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of usability guidelines. You can check all those off and have a god awful website.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've seen it plenty of times.
But it's not to say. I guess I just want to underscore that there is a huge role for those standards because they're, if you look at them as specifications and not as a measure, a yardstick, they specify what needs to be there. And in that role, they're so, so helpful because they guide you toward doing what you need to do. But then at the end of the day, you're crafting experiences for people. Yeah. And that's really where things come into play. And that's where some of the lawsuits are going to come from.
I also think one of the real challenges is that because accessibility has gone a legal route, right? It's a legal regulatory requirement. And that gives it some teeth, right? Because you have to, you know, you have to do it. But it also means that we tend to get into a checklist mentality about it. So every, you know, lawyers hate the words "it depends," and usability people love the word "it depends." And you can't go to your, you know, chief compliance officer and say, and he says, "Well, is this website gonna, you know, hold up in a lawsuit?" And you go, "Well, it depends." Not, it's not an acceptable answer, right? So you get, so it's. When you have a nice checklist, you can say, well, let's just work the checklist. And I think often it gets relegated into this either post-QA legal compliance world. And you need both of them. You need it embedded in the design world, and you need someone checking it. But, you know, just like you check everything. If you built a financial website, you would check that the calculations are right.
I would hope
you wouldn't You wouldn't just trust that, you know, you wouldn't just trust that, the programmer's got the algorithm right that day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you need both ends of that. You need to know what you're aiming for, both in a kind of big picture UX way and in a what does that look like when I look at the code and the application?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're still struggling with, well, not us, but people in the industry are still struggling with something as simple as alt text. There's, you know, I've seen images without alt text, which is clearly a violation. And I've seen people say like, oh, well, yeah, my image has alt text. I'm like, okay, but it's a file name.
Yeah.
That's right. That's not helpful. Yes, you technically have alt text.
My favorite violation of that is when somebody goes and puts in an empty alt attribute just to make sure that they pass the validator. I'm like, that does not make it accessible or valid.
And there's context issues. If you have a picture of JFK wearing a hat and you're writing an article on hats, you might say man with a hat. But if it's an article on John F. Kennedy, you might say John F. Kennedy.
Or you might say man with an astonishingly purple fedora.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, I think understanding that this is design, this is not just technology. Mm-hmm. It's about content and design and what we're communicating. I actually think we should give up on Global Accessibility Awareness Day and have Fix the Damn Alt Text Day.
Yes.
You know, but I say that as a joke, but what I mean is that there are all these little stupid things that aren't embedded in our workflow.
Yeah.
And so we spend a lot of time on things that are just should be no-brainers, and we're not spending time on the stuff that really makes a difference. I had an interesting experience working with a newspaper. We were talking about alt text on images in the articles, not the stuff in the surround or the frame. And the head of the most technical person at the table said, here's the deal. If we can go through our image database and you can tell me which field I can use as alt text, right? Should it be the caption? Should it be whatever it is? Then I can do it tomorrow. If I have to go get a photo editor to write a new field, I have to change the database, I have to change the workflow, we have to think about the fact that the same image might be used in two contexts, and that's a much bigger job. And what we said was, well, let's do both, right? Let's start with, you know, getting some alt text in there, and then let's look at the context in which you use images within an article. Is there ever a case for having null alt text? You know, if it's just a thumbnail, maybe there is, right? And then let's also start thinking about when that's not very helpful alt text, because if you have a long headline and the first thing in the article is a picture and that picture has the same long headline as alt text, it's not a great experience, but it is legal. Now, I don't think anybody's going to sue you because you have the same headline repeated twice. But your goal is to make people want to love your newspaper and make that the place they come for news. So what can we do to make that really helpful?
Mm-hmm. So let's mention that for a moment. In that instance where you have a long headline and an image with that would seemingly have alt text, they have to be different, I assume, because it's just annoying for a screen reader to be super long title then, super image of super long title.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, certainly, if again, back to compliance, from a compliance perspective, if the image text describes the image, then it would be a pass, right? They would meet that success criteria or that standard. But from an experience perspective, you have a redundancy issue where you're getting like over-informed about what's on the screen. And so a lot of times there, you just think about the oral user experience. So you say, okay, this is the visual user experience. You see the title, you see this image, you have the teaser, and then you have the read more link. How can I build an oral experience that's equivalent to that? Mm-hmm. And then knowing what that experience is like and putting the right pieces in place. In some cases, the right answer there is to put a null alt text on that particular image so it's not announced. But if it is adding to the informational aspect and if it's adding to the experience, then it's finding a way to articulate what it is bringing to that experience visually and have that same experience from an audible perspective.
Yeah, so can I push this one step further and say, let's say it's not a read more thing, but it actually is the beginning of the article, and you're a newspaper, or you have real captions. So the value of the caption in describing the image is that everyone sees it. It's not hidden in code. So you might get, you know, John F. Kennedy wears purple fedora, and then the alt text might be just photo of Kennedy in his hat, and then the caption might describe, you know, when and where and why he wore this purple fedora. And now you've got a package where you know that you can minimize the description of the image because there's so much description in the surrounding text, but you have to know how you're using it to know how to write it. It's content, right? It's content. It's not just technology.
Mm-hmm. Just like any other piece of the article.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I'm so glad, Sarah, you brought up the read more link, because I feel like we had this rampant use of click here links.
Oh, God.
And we finally convinced everyone to not use click here links. And then we have this rampant use of read more links, which are just as bad.
Well, except that if the in that clump, if the title, you know, let's say it's a blog post, right? There's a title of the blog and that's a link. Mm-hmm. And then there's a little teaser description. And then there has to be then there's a little link at the end that says, keep going, read more. Mm-hmm. That read more is much less awful when there's already a link on the real title, right? So someone who gets the real title could just say, right, I want to read this article and click on. But if you didn't have some sort of link at the bottom, then you have to back up to find that link. Right. You have to back up visually, and you have to back up if you're navigating in code. And so finding a way to have something there that's the keep going, it makes a difference whether that's the only link to get to the article or not.
It all depends on the context again.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I will actually repeat the title inside of the read more link but hide it from view. So say read more about John F. Kennedy. And the reason I do that is because of the folks who navigate by links only pull all the links out if they see read more.
Right. But again, it's content, and you're thinking about that, and you're probably not doing the entire title of the blog post. You're doing some shortened version. Right. So you're still thinking about content and what that oral experience is.
So when we think about accessibility, a lot of us just default to blind and deaf or visually impaired and deaf. What are some of the other disabilities that we really need to be thinking about?
Well, I would say that we think of blind and deaf. I think you're right in that. And the vision impairments that in some ways are more difficult are low vision or, you know, conditions where you need a high contrast view. And so I feel like we figured out a lot about how to use code and design patterns, like we were just talking about, to create a good audible experience of a web page for someone who can't see it and is using a screen reader. But we don't think very much at all about how to work with people who have functional vision and who are not using screen reader software for their navigation and content. And so when we do usability testing and provide recommendations, for me, some things that have been really eye-opening have been watching people with low vision navigate things like phones and web applications and sites, because it is very complicated and there are great things that we could be doing. So just as an example, we did some work for the MBTA in Boston well, you must know the MBTA very well.
Oh, yeah, we know the MBTA.
Love-hate relationship.
Yeah, they recently had a no-pants day on the train.
Did you guys participate?
I did not.
No.
I'm not sure I really want to know, actually. yeah, so we did work for MBTA, and we had these wonderful interviews with people with disabilities who are users of their services, and we talked about their web and apps and things like that. And just talking about things like how to visually design those schedules so that you can track across a row to find you choose your stop that you're looking for, and you track across the row to figure out what time to be out there waiting for the bus or when you'll arrive where you need to go. And when you do that in a low vision view where you're zoomed in really, really close, you've lost the context of the headers, you've lost the column headers, you've lost the row headers, and you're just looking at numbers swimming in the sea of numbers. And so what that, I think, is an area that we as visual designers, people who are working in visual design, could do so much to get things going for visual design patterns for people with low vision.
Yeah. And I'll throw in, we've been doing a lot of work recently especially at the Center for Civic Design, with people with low literacy, English as a second language, and in our case, people who have low civic engagement, right? I think we really misunderstand how well people read. The National Assessment of Adult Literacy suggests that 43% of the adults in America who can read at less than at basic or below basic levels. It means simple concrete reading terms. It means not drawing a lot of inferences. There's, they don't use text well to draw inferences into the real world. And so when we have poorly designed words, when we have complex concepts, we had a really funny one with voting. We were testing voter guides. And there are three ways to vote. You could vote by mail, you know, absentee voting. You could vote early by going to a vote center, or you could vote on election day. And this guy said, well, ma'am, I'm vote by mail voter because I get this guide in the mail. That makes me vote by mail, right? And if I do get an absentee ballot, I have to mail it before election day so it arrives in time. So that's early voting, right? And so these three concepts, the words are perfectly plain. They're three concepts that sound like, to anybody who's familiar with elections, they sound very discreet. But when you just have the words and you take them very literally, they're actually quite confusing. And this is, so there's a whole other dimension of people with mild cognitive disabilities, reading disabilities. We know that a lot of things that make people not be able to read well are actually visual, like not being able to track across a line. We're finally rediscovering, you know, space between the lines of text. like every typographer knew about, but somehow it didn't happen in, you know, applications. And then there are all the people who don't think of themselves as having a disability. We now routinely leave a set of reading glasses on the table in our usability lab, and or have them with us wherever we're going. And the number of people who reach for them and say, oh, we're on a screen. Wait, I better have these glasses. So these aren't people who think I'm disabled. Of course, very few people think I'm disabled, actually. But they don't identify as having a visual disability. But in fact, they have trouble reading the screen, just seeing it if it's not big enough. And, you know, there's a disability is a big, you know, ability is a spectrum. And we need to think about everybody along those spectrums.
I think that's a great note to close on, and mm-hmm. a very important point. And it was wonderful to hear it stated that way.
Okay.
It was good. It's very clear and easy to understand for people.
So before we close up, if someone's just new to accessibility, real quickly, what should they start with? What's a good resource for them to get a hold of, besides the book? Obviously,
the book.
We have this great resource. We love WebAIM. If you're looking for some technical guidance, I think WebAIM is a really great place to start. It's a website that's part of a center at the University of... I forget, sorry. but they've been around. They have some really clear technical articles and good examples. And it's a little easier to navigate than the WAI site, which is the home of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. Mm-hmm. But that's another great place. Easy Checks. We have a podcast on Easy Checks. It was designed for, oh, I'm starting this out. How do I take the first steps?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's great. So if people want to buy the book, they can rosenfeldmedia.com. It's called A Web for Everybody. I recommend it personally. I think it's a great book. If you're starting out or you've been in accessibility for a long time, definitely pick up this book.
And there's tons of great resources online. We have all the principles online with the guidelines. We've mapped them to WCAG. And we've got a set of personas for people with disabilities, for people to just get started thinking about the range of experience.
Great. And if people want to contact you individually, what's the best way to do that?
Well, we have a Twitter feed for the book, which is at A Web for Everyone.
Yep, and I am at Gradual Clearing.
And I'm at Whitney Q.
You can get us on Twitter at The Dirt Show, and please send your long-winded comments to thedirt@freshtilledsoil.com. Please review us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're listening to us now on, unless you're driving. Don't review us while you drive. Once again, I want to thank Sarah and Whitney for taking time out of your day. This was outstanding. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. That's all we have for today, and we will try and do better next time.
If you had to guess out of any of the people whose names you know, who's sitting in a breakfast nook right now?
Oh, let's see. Well, it's definitely someone in California. It's not going to be somebody young. It's going to be an early riser because it's 7, but they're probably going to have to get up a half hour ago to get into a breakfast nook at 7, assuming they didn't shower yet. Let's see, a middle-aged Christian Bale.
Really?
Yeah.
You think Christian Bale's in a breakfast nook right now?
Yeah.
You think Batman is in a breakfast nook?
Yeah.